Good morning and welcome to Talking About California, a series of discussions with California who talk about this state, their home, and their work here. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm your host. This morning, our guest is Carl Finnemore. Carl is a Bay Area activist and a writer, and I should add a good friend and comrade. Carl, by way of introduction, as with so many of us, was radicalized as a young man, particularly in the course of the Vietnam War, but perhaps with a difference. Unlike so many of the students of his age, Carl was working class in background, blue collar, really, the son of a Chicago truck driver. And I think that may have put a stamp on him, one that's still there. His life is a story of commitment and activism, but primarily in the labor movement. But not only that, he's been a steel worker, a chemical worker, and an airline worker. He's still an active member, and he's a retired president of the Machinists Union Local 1781. Again, he's also a writer, most recently for Counterpunch, Znet, In These Times, Beyond Cron, and Talking Union. And I might add that he's also, and we've been involved in this together, a supporter of a new union in California, the National Union of Healthcare Workers, who are, as we speak, engaged in a critical election with the Service Employees International Union, and the at issue is who will represent 45,000 Kaiser Permanente workers. We might have a chance to get that to that toward the end. But Carl, good morning.
Good morning, Cal. Thank you.
Oh, it's great to hear you, Carl. Maybe since I took this from your biography, maybe you could say a bit about your background. I don't think the anti-war movement was really so thoroughly middle class as people say, but blue collar kids were not the norm. Is that right? Where and how did you get involved?
Well, I'm 66 years old now, so I grew up in the 50s, which, as you know, was very repressive. But I don't know if the youth of today can really appreciate how stringent, strident, and conservative it was. I mean, just remember that Elvis Presley was a big challenge to the whole status quo. I mean, they just freaked out when he swiveled his hips. That's how conservative it was, politically and socially. It was no, no, no to any new thinking, new books, creative ideas, the way you dress, wear your hair, swivel your hips, the music you listen to. It was all programmed. So the kids who grew up in the 50s were coming of age. They're naturally imaginative and curious because so many changes were happening around us. You had to pay attention. The civil rights movement, the colonial revolution in Africa, everything was exploding and changing around us except the power structure. So it was natural to rebel and question, and for me, and then I was educated in a Catholic system for 12 years, which was very repressive as well, of course. My first act of civil disobedience was to refuse to be an altar boy. They forced me to be an altar boy, and then I refused to learn Latin, and then so they had to kick me out. I was the only kid that, and they're ever that refused to be an altar boy, to my knowledge, in that school, and they freaked out. But that was a successful act of civil disobedience at the age of 10. I didn't even realize it. I just didn't want to be an altar boy for people that hit me and struck me. You know, every time I'd ask a question, they consider rebellious. So, you know, I was changing already by the time I came of age, a teenager. And the anti-Vietnam War movement, the civil rights movement, and the opportunity to read books and to listen to different speakers that would come to the University of Illinois in Chicago, which I was able to attend because it was $90 a semester. So working-class kids could go to school and learn. But I was way behind everybody. Everybody else knew more than I did. as you alluded to, they came from, most people just came from better backgrounds. We had no books in our house and didn't really talk about issues. It was survival mode for my working class family in Chicago. And so I just was like a sponge absorbing everything new that was happening around me. And there was such injustice that what my mom and dad did give me was love, and that sustained me. And I remember my mom, after I came home from a fight, and I had blood on my shirt, I went into my bedroom at about 14 years of age, snuck in, she came in, she said, "Oh my God, you're fighting again." I go, "Mom, I won, don't worry about it," I remember. And she told me, "Carl, we don't want you to hate anybody." And I just, because that's the way they lived. They were very nice, simple people, had no grudge against anybody. It really, when I contrasted the love that they showed me to the violence of the society and the government, it stuck to me. So I was very open to a more peaceful ideology and framework. And I just had to sift through it, listen to all the different speakers, read all the different books, and I became radicalized. The Vietnam War was a horrific form of barbarism. It was largely defenseless people. So that's why so many of us did radicalize over that issue, and me in particular.
Okay. Makes sense to me. Now, listen, we have to jump ahead a bit, if you don't mind, but you can always change the subject on me, Carl. But I thought in thinking about talking with you that something that maybe a little different than the workers might, I mean, the listeners might be interested in would be your years as a worker for United Airlines in, that's, I think, San Francisco International Airport. You might fill us in a bit. How'd you get to California, and how'd you get to United Airlines? But would you mind if we talked about some of the issues for, you know, summer's coming, people are thinking about traveling, but flying's not what it used to be. Maybe you could, how did you get to California and then up here?
Well, as I became radicalized and joined the in the 60s, joined anti-war, volunteer anti-war groups of students and young people. We would fundraise for ourselves, and then we would, after I graduated, we would send ourselves all over the country to help organize protests and give our experience to others. So I moved to New York. I went to Washington, D.C. for the big demonstrations, marched around the UN. Martin Luther King came out against the war in 1960. Just before he was assassinated, and went to L.A., and then came to San Francisco. And in 1973, I came to Oakland, Berkeley, San Francisco. And after the war ended, I had to get what I called a straight job. So I worked in machine shops. I worked in the Chevron refinery. I worked at U.S. Steel in Pittsburgh, California, all good union jobs. And then I landed a job 20 years ago at United Airlines as a baggage handler, loading airplanes. And I was elected to various union positions, finally retiring, as you say, as the president. And the airlines, really, in the last 20 years, have been at the center of the attack, corporate attack, against working people. It's now shifted to public workers in the last 5 years, but really the last 20 years, airlines took a lot of the heat because airlines to this day remain the biggest unionized component of the working class. And they were among the better paid, they had the best benefits, they had pensions, and they all had national contracts. That is, if you lived in Podunk, Iowa, you made the same wages as somebody in a high cost of living San Francisco. National contracts. It was really a very good place to work. You could raise a family and buy a home. All that changed.
But that was hard work, wasn't it? I mean, your job, what were you doing?
loading those heavy, crazy heavy bags at in the pit of an aircraft on your knees, lifting these 70 to 130-pound parcels over your head at a rapid rate and just stuffing every inch of that pit with mail, with batteries, hundreds of pound batteries. I got my back hurt the first 2 weeks. Disc L5, as I've now become expert. All the baggage handlers are expert with the spinal column. They know it all. So my L5 is still out. But it happens to these huge young guys. No matter how big you are, you're going to twist your body. You're going to do the fast speed up thing, and you're going to get hurt. Your knees, back, shoulders. And so, yeah, it is a very dangerous job because they cut back manpower, people power, labor power, and they speed it up. So that's the job I did. And, I as all the workers in the airlines, at the same time we're working harder and the companies are making more money, our wages went down. Our benefits went down. Since around the mid-90s, these things began to happen.
And how did it? How would it happen
in the bankruptcy?
Can you explain? I mean, would you get a pay cut? Would you just not get a raise?
Yeah. Well, there hasn't been a strike in the airline industry since Eastern 1989, which went out of business, and the workers were really forced to strike in that case. There has been no strikes, and what happened is that since the 1990, there's been 189 airlines that have gone into bankruptcy. Now, most you haven't heard of. They're fly-by-night outfits. They come and they go. But all the majors have been through bankruptcy. That's Delta. That's American is still in bankruptcy. That's U.S. Air. The America West was. Many of these airlines don't exist. And United had the longest one, 3 years. In 2002 to 2005, longest one in corporate history, bankruptcy, which the bankruptcy laws allow them to throw out, rip up, voted on, agreed upon collective bargaining agreements, and to terminate pensions or other liabilities that interfere with the company staying in business, or the way I would say it, making a profit. And so United Airlines dumped our pension. The government had to take it over, and then they proceeded to cut it by a third. But at least, thank God, there is a government, quasi-government institution that the unions helped establish through legislation in the 70s to protect terminated pensions. But it's just wrong to allow companies to just unilaterally just dump them. Because we negotiated those pensions. We gave up wages and other benefits to have those pensions for the last 60 years of negotiations. And and then we had our wages cut 21%. This all happened in between 2002-2003. That's a lot. That's a big cut, 21%.
So who did that again?
The bankruptcy court.
Okay.
Upon the request of United Airlines management, cut our wages 21%, extended the period of time that you would get your top wages for new employees from 5 years to 10 years. Now, those cuts and everything I talked about, termination of pensions, has been universally applied, more or less, to every single major airline. That was at Northwest Airlines, which now merged with Delta, non-union Delta. It was true of U.S. Airways, which now has been eaten up by American Airlines. By the way, American Airlines is in bankruptcy now, but they're allowed to go buy a huge airline, number five airline, U.S. Air, but they're in bankruptcy. Cutting wages and freezing their pension, American Airlines has froze the pension. They want to terminate it, but they've only been granted relief to freeze it at this point. So there's been devastating attacks. You have to work 10 years now in the airlines, in no matter what category you work in order to get top wages, as a general rule. So you're 18, you won't get top wages till you're 28. And those wages have been slashed. So, and you very likely do not have a pension. Very likely, unless you're represented by my union, the Machinists Union, which did, fortunately, in the contracts in the airlines that they represent, got an IAM union pension plan as we exited bankruptcy at United and at Northwest and at US Air.
So but, it's a little hard to follow, Carl. We're living in an age when apparently competition is supposed to be the answer for everything in a free market, and yet you're describing consolidation. I think you use the term for me, airlines that are too big to fail. Do you have any explanation for what's happening there?
Well, you're right. There's now really only three major airlines. That's Delta, which bought up Northwest, United, which bought up Continental, and American, which bought up US Air, which had previously, just 3 years ago, bought up America West. These are names that you might have heard of. That have been merged. So you really have three. Plus, if you add the domestic carrier, Southwest, those four airlines comprise 85% of the air traffic in the United States. So by its very nature, competition is reduced. Prices will go up, but especially on routes where only one of those carriers service. But that's not the real factor of driving this monopoly in the skies, the same that drives the monopoly on the ground, the drive for increased profit. You get rid of your competition, you have a monopoly on the market, you could raise prices. That hasn't happened dramatically yet, the increase in prices. It will. For instance, from Sacramento to San Francisco, if you buy a ticket from United Airlines today, you will be charged $280 to $380. Well, that's a lot of money to go 44 minutes on an aircraft. So because there's not a lot of flights, there's not a lot of competition between San Francisco and Sacramento. So that's the future, really. But the prices, as I say, they have not appreciably risen. What has risen is the fees. $38 billion in fees last year the airlines charged customers. The hidden rise in costs. That's for getting seats, that's upgrade the seats, that's for baggage fees, that's for cancellation fees. That's for being first in line to board the aircraft. I mean, you think of it, and they've got a fee for it. But that's so they can try to, for the public, their public image, keep the prices down, but really their profits go up. All the time, there's been no increase for the workers, nor has there been increased service for the consumer. They have fewer aircraft, smaller, more fuel-efficient aircraft flying, less direct flights, so you have to go through a hub, pick up more passengers before you go to Des Moines or to other cities, even Minneapolis, other Detroit, other cities which used to have just a lot of nonstop. You have less direct flights now, too, which inconvenienced the public a lot.
Carl, let me interrupt for a minute. This is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow, your host this morning. Our program is talking about California. And this morning we're talking with the activist and writer from San Francisco, Carl Finnemore. And we've started off our discussion with a little about his experience as a longtime worker and union activist in the airline industry. So, Carl, how does this affect the flyer? You know, I think I said at the beginning, except for a bout of fear of flying, I used to like to fly, and now it's kind of something that I dread heading for the airport. Can you connect the consumer and the experience of the consumer with what's happened to the worker?
Yeah, well, as I said, they're trying to stuff, and they do stuff, more passengers into every flight by reducing the flight and having smaller aircraft service. And less 777s, less 747s from San Francisco to Chicago, for instance, and more 737s, smaller. The capacity of airlines 20 years ago, when I got hired in, was 72 to 73% average capacity, and that was the profit. If you achieved that, you made a profit. Now, airlines' average plane is filled 92% capacity. That's incredible. That just means there's less seat options, more crowded. I mean, who wants to be in the middle seat? Now, if you're lucky enough to be in these Mileage Plus programs, you can get upgraded. But even that, with these mergers, that's hundreds of millions of more miles that have been added from U.S. Air to Delta's Mileage Plus, and Continental's millions and hundreds of millions of miles added to United's existing Mileage Plus type programs. So you're going to have tens of thousands of more passengers, which with hundreds of millions of miles added up, all competing for the upgrade seated aircraft with fewer seats. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It definitely impacts the convenience of passengers, and I would say that passengers have to feel they're going into a cattle car more at prime prices. But there's no competition. They're too big to fail. That's why the National Mediation Board, the government, has to release airline workers and rail workers to strike, because it's such a national, since the 1920s, that was the law, since it's such an important strategic commercial activity, blah, blah, blah. But they don't give us the right to strike. They say there's not enough airlines. You can't strike. That's why there hasn't been any strikes for 20 years, and negotiations drag on. In the case of this United Airlines, over 3 years. They just made a proposal to the members, and the members rejected it 3-1. Because the wage proposals that United made a few months ago would not have matched what we were making in 2002, right on the eve of bankruptcy. Isn't that incredible? That's 11 years ago. They want to pay us something that won't even match what we made 11 years ago. So it was voted down. But that just gives you an idea of the appetite of these people who are running the airlines.
But I don't get the connection, Carl. The bigger you are, the less able you are to go on strike?
Oh, well, because the government, the National Mediation Board, determines if a strike is in the best interest of the country. If a strike interferes with commerce too dramatically, then they don't let you strike. That applies, that's the National Railway Labor Act in effect since the 1920s. That affects railroads and airlines. So, for instance, in 1966, there was a strike against the machinist union, struck against all five airlines. And they got their wage increases of something like 5%. Lyndon Johnson, during the Vietnam War, wanted to limit it to 3.5%. And we won, but then a law was passed, you can only strike one airline at a time. And now that one airline has become just about no airline can you strike, because the argument back then was if you take all five airlines out, it affects commerce too much. Well, then have the commercial entities pay decent wages, and we won't go on strike. Workers don't go on strike. It's very difficult for them to endure a strike. There weren't that many of them, so it has to be really serious. Now it's become, in effect, nobody can go on strike. The government won't say this, but they will not release you. 5 years ago, there was a case of our railway workers, the machinist union railway workers, negotiating for 14 years. They were not allowed by the government to go on strike for the reason I'm saying, that they say it interferes with commerce. The president would put an injunction on it. The president has the right to put an injunction and stop people from going on strike. And that's what, in effect, they threaten. They just drag on negotiations, and the company realizes you don't have the right to strike, so they don't have to offer you much.
And these bankruptcy courts then have real power.
And the bankruptcy court, too. They give the company a right to stay in business but rip up a democratically approved and negotiated contract. So really, for airline workers, we've given up, in effect, the right to taken away from us the right to strike and the right to really negotiate in good faith collective bargaining agreements. You can just get out of them. So you see, my point is, when there's only three major airlines, if you go on strike against one, the government says air traffic has been reduced by 33%. That's too much in the interest of the company, in the interest of the country. We're going to let the company do whatever it wants. I mean, that's the union. That's what a good union person would say. Yeah, you. So if you don't, you know, it's the old argument. Commerce is affected when you have strikes. Yeah, that's true. But the argument that the government makes with airline and rail workers is the price is too big to pay. You don't have the right to strike. Now, Freedom of Information Act, I just wrote as a writer, as you said, I write periodically. I asked for documents related to this from the government, and they said, they just wrote me back a couple of days ago, said this is privileged information that cannot be released. So they will never publicly say what I'm saying, but you just look at the evidence over the last 20 years.
So you were talking about, well, this is the union point of view. You rose up through the ranks to become president. How about just a word about that before we switch subjects? Becoming a union officer, were you a full-timer, or did you work on the job? And you said you started off as a steward. Maybe you'd tell us that story briefly.
Yeah, I very quickly became a steward and elected the chairman of the steward committee of what was the largest local at the time in the Machinist Union. We had 13,000 at SFO. The United Airlines maintenance space was a big part of it, but we also represented Northwest Airline workers, U.S. Air workers, Hawaiian, Alaska. So we were a very large local by most standards. And I just saw on a daily basis how the company just had the upper hand, because they could just deny grievances, and what are you going to do? No, we're going to turn you down. Go to arbitration. Well, the union can't go to arbitration. It costs, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 every arbitration, and it takes a long time to schedule all the appeals and so forth. And what the whole process showed is that it distances the worker from the complaint they have into this nebulous, complicated legal process, which, as it proceeds up the ladder of appeal after appeal and arbitration, there's more distance between the issue at hand and the worker who first raised the issue. And it's just a bad part of the union. It accounts for why there's a separation. And I saw it firsthand. I was trying to get the workers involved, but there was a separation for so many decades of the workers and their complaints. We don't have the right to have job actions. We don't have the right to strike in the middle of a contract. All that has been taken away from us. We don't have a right to slow down to make our point. We don't have a right to walk off the job. None of those things do we have the right. So the only thing we can do is file paperwork and have it go up this unbelievable. It makes Congress look like a very efficient machine. If you want to, you know, the grievance procedure in the United States is just horrible. Of all the tens of thousands of grievances filed in the United States, years ago I looked into it, and only 1 to 2% go to arbitration, and the union wins half and the company wins half. But that, what about the other 98%? You see, it contributes to the growing frustration. So from my vantage point as an officer, interested in mobilizing and activating and educating and arousing the membership to their real interest, I found, unfortunately, a lot of disenchantment, a lot of demoralization, because they didn't understand that the process is what was stacked against us to slow it down. And it wasn't really the union. It was the way this whole process had been forced on us by national anti-labor legislation, which took away the power of workers to resolve their grievances directly. And it passed it on to this process filled with lawyers and arbitrators, so distant from the workers themselves. So it was a kind of a frustrating experience for somebody who was more accustomed to mass organizing during the 60s and 70s.
But you're still active. You're still active in San Francisco labor politics, is that right?
Yeah, yes I am. I'm a delegate to the Labor Council from the Machinist Union. And, you know, the attacks on Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, I'm active in some of the old-timer groups now, too, as well. And, you know, we have a senior group in our union, about 75 of us meet every month and talk about issues and go on picket lines, even the old-timers in their 70s and 80s. Those are the people who went through the strikes of the 60s and 70s, these old-timers. So they know what it is to stand up.
Okay, well, that's all pretty interesting and I think informative, although it looks like we're going to have a way to go before flying gets to be fun again.
Yeah.
Can I switch subjects, Carl?
Sure.
I happen to know from following you a bit and listening to you talk that you, in the past couple of years, have become an authority on the movements for freedom, democracy, and so forth in the Middle East. I think you've been there more than once. Maybe you could tell us. I know you've been to. You've been to Egypt, haven't you?
Yes, that's the country.
That seems like a big deal, long way away. Had you been to the Middle East before you went this first time?
No, what drew me was just the passion and bravery of the young people trying to change their government, you know, and establish rights. So the Arab Spring, which first started in Tunisia in late 2010, November 2010, that's got my attention. And then when it spread to Egypt, the largest country in the Arab world, the largest army of 500,000 and another 500,000 in reserve in the Arab world, the cultural center of the Arab world, that got my attention. So I just picked up and was planning to go. My buddy calls me from Seattle, and he says, "Hey, Carl, Mubarak's going to go, man. You got to go now. He's going to fall." I go, "Really?" And I just left. I packed my bag, and I was at San Francisco Airport in 2 hours and took the plane, and I happened to arrive 3 hours after Mubarak was deposed. So I was very lucky. I saw the celebration. I arrived February 11th. 2011, and it's just a scene of revolution. I was in my element of just millions of people, young people, women, all groups, classes, all getting rid of the dictator. Of course, in the last couple of years, I've been back every year on the anniversary, so it's 3 times so far. Things have changed. There's differentiation. It's one thing to get rid of the dictator. There's a lot of unity. There was a lot of unity around that because Mubarak, you know, was reported to have stolen his family's $70 billion, you know, owned an incredible amount of wealth or, you know, stole an incredible amount of land and factories and businesses and extended to his family and friends overseas friends, domestic friends, licenses to plunder legally just about anything they wanted. So it just gripped the whole society. They finally had enough, and they got rid of him. But it's something else when you start then, after getting rid of the dictator, to try to figure out how to build the new society. That's where different classes, different social forces have different opinions, and that's what we've seen the last 2 years, is that struggle, much more serious and deep-going struggle. But what's important is that the struggle amidst that those controversies that have developed in the last 2 years, the struggle to change Egypt fundamentally has not been extinguished. It hasn't died out. 60% of the population is under 30 years of age. They, as they tell me, have no future. We have no choice but to fight and the struggle.
So how do you know these people? You get there, you get off the airplane at the airport in where, Cairo, Alexandria, what do you do?
I just go right in there and I just hit Tahrir Square, hit the downtown area, hit the parliament area.
You took a taxi? What do you speak?
The first time I was there, I immediately started talking to a cab driver who was bemoaning the fact that there were no tourists and that these protests should end. So I said, oh, man. But I was a cab driver myself. I know the mentality of cab drivers. You know, they're not the most socially conscious in the whole world. They want tourists to come back, so there's a little police and there's lots of corruption. So what? At least the tourists are here and I get my tips. But that was a minority position for sure, though there's always that element of people who want stability. They don't want struggle. So I immerse myself in the crowds and just start talking and interviewing. And there's always someone to speak English. And some will say he's a spy, he's a CIA agent, he's, you know, don't spread our business to a foreigner. There's some people like that always, but the crowd always defended me. There were more who understood that it was important to get the word out than it was to mistreat a foreigner. So the people have been very accessible. I interviewed people from the Muslim Brotherhood. I interviewed from the government trade union, which opposed the revolution. They were in the bureaucratic union in Mubarak's pocket. They attacked the revolution, actually, physically, during the 18 days of revolution that toppled Mubarak. I interviewed them. I interviewed hundreds of young people, radicals, trade unionists, civil rights, activists, NGOs, and that's how and ordinary people, just walking the streets and asking people's opinions, business people and so forth. And that's how you get an opinion. And the general opinion is that the best organized forces are those who have more power and status in the society. That's the leftovers from Mubarak, that's the military, and that's the Muslim Brotherhood. Very well organized. And that's why they're the ones winning elections. Not necessarily are they the most popular. Whereas the youth, they're not as well organized. They're poorly organized. They weren't allowed to be organized. The Muslim Brotherhood has been around since the 1920s. They were forced underground here and there, but they've been also catered to by various regimes over the decades as well to engage in violence against what they call secularists, trade unionists, those who wanted to continue to nationalize instead of privatize, those who oppose neocolonial economic policies of letting the foreign corporations get big subsidies and free trade zones. Muslim Brotherhood has a neoliberal, conservative, Alan Greenspan, Milton Friedman policy that would rival anybody in the Western world. And they were used by Sadat and Mubarak for those purposes to get rid of the academics, trade unionists who opposed them. So all the dissidents, they didn't have a chance to organize before the last couple of years. They were repressed. Whereas the Muslim Brotherhood, that wasn't always the case, and certainly wasn't the case of the military, of course, and the leftovers from Mubarak. So those are the ones who are forming the parties and driving the whole process. And the people you see on the streets are the less organized but more passionate young people, the women, and the independent unions who want to break away from the official bureaucratic union. And they are very powerful. There were 2,400 strikes or worker protests, not all strikes. Some form of protest have been documented in 2012 at the work sites. That's bus drivers, metro drivers, hospital workers, tax collectors union. That's textile workers, oil workers, natural gas workers.
Well, let's come back. Come back to that, Carl. Let me interrupt you. Sorry. I just need to tell listeners that this is KZYX, and our program this morning is talking about California. And I'm interrupting, I'm sorry to say, my guest this morning, Carl Finnemore, who's a Bay Area labor activist and writer follower, supporter of movements in Egypt, where he's been several times, and he's telling me about that now. Before we get back to that, where could a reader go to see something you've written about Egypt?
Well, just Google Carl Finnemore. It's Finnamore, and Egypt, and you get a lot of stuff.
Okay, Carl Finnemore, Egypt. Go to Google, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That'll do it. That's the simplest way.
Okay, well, let me get back to, so you were talking about different groups of workers in Egypt who've been active. Maybe we could have a little bit more.
They have really been active. Now, here's the thing. Here's the contradiction. You have the working class, which had the biggest general strike in Egypt's history, 3 days or 4 days before Mubarak just left. He was forced out by the military. They virtually shut down the country in 15 cities. It was very powerful. These independent working class strikes and protests just had a dramatic effect and were really responsible for kicking him out. Since that time, they've continued their strikes, and they've won real gains for themselves at local plant levels, where they are stronger at their work sites, whether it's a hospital or a government office or a factory. They are stronger. Where they're weak is they have not nationalized their struggle. They have not nationally coordinated it. They don't have experience in doing that. They don't even know how to be stewards, how to collect dues, how to write a constitution. All this is a learning process that was denied to them because they were forced to be part of the bureaucratic Mubarak union of 3 million. Which was, as I say, was very conservative and supported Mubarak and opposed the insurrection, physically fought the insurrection and was defeated by the young people. And so the problem with both the youth and the workers is they do not nationally coordinate their actions. They do not coordinate their demands, that is, social demands of the young people for freedom, for women's rights, for democratic rights, with the economic rights that are so important to the workers. They don't link them together. So it's a question of organization. So you'll see that the people who are candidates for president who incorporate the best of the youth and the students, Khalid Al-Ali, one of the foremost labor attorney, brave person, radical socialist, he got only 1% of the vote. He wasn't organized. He had no money. His voice didn't get out. So the Muslim Brotherhood, which opposes the minimum wage, whose parliament has not passed one single reform for women or, as I say, for minimum wage or anything. Now, the courts have passed some of those, but the parliament controlled under pressure, they did. But the parliament under Muslim Brotherhood has not passed one reform. In fact, they're proposing under the International Monetary Fund suggested loan as part of it to cut the subsidies for bread. Each person receives 5 loaves of bread a day. They live on that. That's important. They want to cut that. They want to cut natural gas facilities, subsidies that feed people in their homes, the gas stoves. So this is only proposed to get worse, the economic proposals of the Muslim Brotherhood, yet they win elections because they're the best organized. So it's not enough in revolution to have passion if you're going to take on the power structure. You got to have organization. That's what's missing among these bravest people you'll ever meet, both workers and young people and the women you'll ever meet on the face of the earth.
Do you want to give us a thumbnail description of maybe some youngster that you talk to, a woman or a young worker or both?
There's so many wonderful discussions, but they left me with such mixed feelings, because here we have an unemployed accountant, unemployed translator, unemployed business person, a student who can't go back to school, an attorney, doctors. Several of them, when I came back in the second year, had been blinded because the police are targeting women. Goons target women, and they target young people, and they shoot their bullets made in the U.S., their ball-bearing bullets, at the pavement so that they go up and they hit the eye. And so one, several I met and interviewed in 2011. I came back in 2012. They were blind in one eye. And as one of them said to me, he said, "But my spirit has not been diminished one bit. I'm more determined than ever to fight those who preach religion, fight those who preach, power for the few." And they relate very much to the Occupy movement in the United States, and they have great pride when I tell them that the Occupy movement looked to the protesters in Tahrir. They have great pride in that, but modesty as well. There's others who I met who sitting in Tahrir in disheveled clothes, unemployed young people, 28 years old. He says, "I do not have a wife," which at 28 for a man is very serious stain on what's expected of you from your family. You don't have enough money to take a wife and to raise a family. So he said, "My life is over. I have no job. I have no wife. I have no children. So I am fighting for my young nephew and cousins for a better day. So we have no choice but to fight and to give our lives." And there's just hundreds and thousands of stories like that from these young people. But they can only fight so much. It takes more than passion.
And do you think
the military is very powerful? The Ministry of Interior, all dressed up in their new uniforms and new vehicles, tear gas made in Philadelphia. I have photos on my website of the tear gas made in Philadelphia, the uniforms made in the USA. They're brutal. They're devastatingly brutal. They're Mubarak leftovers. And the revolution, scattered them. They tore off their uniforms. They ran away. There were no secret police for months. My first visit, you couldn't find them. But they're coming back. The Muslim Brotherhood is bringing them back, reinforcing them, and hasn't had any reforms within them, which is a big complaint. They're still a murder machine. And the army tries to step back from it all and let the security police of 1 million do the dirty work, because the army is about business. They own 30 to 35% of the economy, according to academics, and it's state secrets of what they own. But that's the conservative figure is 15 to upwards of 35%. Let's put it this way: when they were running the government, they gave $1 billion to the government to prevent a shortfall while they were in power. And what military can give $1 billion to the government? It's like Caesar used to give out land in Gaul to his generals. Well, that's what they do in Egypt. You can't pass it on to your kids. You just, if you die, the next general. That's how they keep, they're completely tied into the power structure and to the economy. So no change will come from them. but you got to be well organized. Now, the one thing is about the military is there's a draft, universal draft, so they're working class kids. They all have a family member, so they're not reliable as the terrible secret police, professional cadre of killers. The army can be split, and that's why they refused. The generals were very wise to refuse Mubarak's instruction to unleash a massacre. That's according to the noted journalist Robert Fisk from The Guardian, the London Guardian. Very reputable source. I happen to believe him that Mubarak made that request, and the army refused and said, you got to go. And they refused because they didn't think they could hold on to their troops, massacring their family members. So it's a very, you know, unsettled question in Egypt. It's a stalemate, I describe it as, in favor of the power structure.
Are you going back, Carl?
I hope to go back every year at the anniversary of the revolution. So I've gone back three times, and 2014, January, will be the fourth. If my legs hold out.
Okay, I think they will. Well, it's been really very interesting. Now, back home, we've got a few minutes left. As we speak, they're counting up the ballots in an election in California for which union will represent Kaiser Permanente's 45,000 service and tech unions. On the one hand, there's the Service Employees International Union, a big national union. On the other hand, there's a new union, home in the Bay Area, the National Union of Healthcare Workers. You've gotten involved in that issue. Maybe you could say a word about it. People might see stories in the press this week about the election, and we'll all be wondering about the outcome.
Well, you know, this is a very interesting point. It's very controversial among politically active union people. Some people say, look, unions in the private sector only represent 8% or so. What the heck are people arguing over 45,000 Kaiser workers who are already in a union? Why don't you go after the others? Well, you see, the reason that people are not there's many reasons people aren't joining unions. There's a lot of anti-labor laws that prevent it. There's obstruction, company interference. But it's also that people don't see unions as really winning good contracts, standing up to the power structure. They see them making concessions repeatedly. So they're not the most attractive force. Remember, in the 1930s, the big wave of joining unions occurred in the wake of three great strikes in 1934. One of them was the longshore strike that shut down the port of San Francisco. After that, the restaurant workers in San Francisco went to the ILWU and said, hey, we want to join you. Everybody flocked in. Now, they formed their own unions. The ILWU said, go form your own unions. That's why restaurant workers were first organized in the Bay Area, in San Francisco. And that will happen again when unions become the beacon for change. Stand up, win, lose, or draw. Stand up to the power structure and throw a few punches. When that begins to happen, more people will just run to join the union, despite all the obstacles. They'll overcome them. And that's what this battle over 45,000 Kaiser workers is. What kind of union? It's not just to have a union. They've raised it to a new level of what kind of union. Do you want to have a union like, in this case, the hospital workers of service employees who makes concessions to a company that is making hundreds of millions, several billion dollars, actually, in profits? They call themselves a nonprofit. I mean, they make an enormous amount of money each year, which goes to their corporate heads who get incredible perks. Or do you want it to go to a rank-and-file-led democratic union which says no and has joined up with the 17,000 Kaiser nurses to say no? We have to consider patient care, patient services, and the health care workers that serve the patients should be compensated as well, fairly, so that they can do their job under safe conditions where they're not exhausted, where they have sick leave, where they have pension, where they enjoy health care benefits. How ironic that Kaiser wants to reduce the health care benefits, charge the employees more. That's the absurdity of it all. So it's a big fight over what kind of union, which I think is integral to rejuvenating the labor standards in the United States.
If you had to say a word in summing up here about yourself, Carl, and this has been a very interesting interview, if what would you like to see to come out of your efforts? What have you been fighting for all these years? What do you see in these workers, you know, struggling for a better contract, for a union? What is it that moves you? And then we'll probably have to call this off.
Well, my whole life, my heroes were working class guys, just ordinary people, like were raised in my family, but they had ideas. I would go to their little small tenements in New York's Lower East Side when I moved to New York, and I would see books. They were well-read, confident, but they lived simply. They had big ideas, but lived simply, and they had confidence in themselves, and they had ideas. So, and the biggest idea they had is that the working class can change history. Ordinary working people, you know, working class, those who have to earn a living by their labor. They don't get stocks and bonds. They don't live off that. They live off their labor. That's about 80, 90% of the people. That's what I, when I say working class. And if the working class can have confidence in itself, if it can have an internationalist perspective, no borders, if it can adopt a point of view that says our unity and a purpose can overcome anything, that we deserve justice for those 80, 90% of the population before the 1%. That I would consider a great signal event. And people like Spartacus Army, they'll take over the world. There's nothing stopping them if they have that confidence and force of will.
All right. Well, there's something to think about. And I think that our listeners will have heard the passion in your voice. And I hope that they, in turn, will get a little impassioned by it. I always enjoy talking to you and hearing about the experiences you've had in places like Egypt, but also on the tarmac at San Francisco International. So, Carl, thank you. This is Talking About California, our program this morning. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm your host. This morning we've been talking to Carl Finnemore, a Bay Area union activist, anti-war activist, and writer who's talked to us about his experience as a union man in the airline industry, about his visits to Cairo. And you can find out more about him yourself by looking at his website, and he suggests, is this right, Carl? You Google Carl Finnemore, CarlFinnamore, and you'll find out a lot more about him. But in the meantime, Carl, thank you very much. It's been really interesting and informative to listen to you.
Thank you, Cal, and say hello to Faith, my best to you both.
All right, and good morning, listeners. We'll talk to you next week at the same time.